Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This evening I wanted to talk something about the practice of arousing insight, understanding, vision of the nature of this thing which we call the body and the mind, to gain some understanding and insight. Is an important part of this practice, even though sometimes that I might emphasize the tranquility of the mind. Ajahn Chah would always say that the tranquility and the insight are just two sides of a knife. Here we would say the two sides of a same coin. They cannot really be split up. However, that sometimes it's useful to emphasize one above the other. This evening, being coming towards the end part of the retreat, is a good opportunity to start to focus on this thing which we call insight. As I understand it and as I explain it, that insight is of two types. First is the insight which we develop along the path. The might call it the ordinary insights about life, about monastic life, about meditation practice and so forth. And there are the great insights, the ones which destroy defilements once and for all. However, that one has to begin with these smaller insights, even though these smaller insights might be very powerful and appear great, they don't destroy defilements, and that's why, for want of a better word, I call them small insights. However, those small insights are very important. Not only do they clear away obstacles, they also propel you forward along the path of deeper understanding. One of the sutras I was reading during my retreat was the Kosambya Sutta, where the right view, which the Buddha was talking about, is actually, this is the right view of the stream enterer. It's one way you can know whether it's the right view or not of the stream enterer, whether it leads to peace, whether it's following and developing and making much of that right view, whether you develop those states of upasama, the quietness, the serenity of the mind, the samatha states. Because the insights have that function at this early stage of the practice. They should develop tranquility. And that tranquility can be the tranquility of just one's general life in the monastery. One gains insight and understanding into those things which cause trouble to the mind or to the body in living monastic life. One gains insight into those things which create trouble and disturbance when one sits down to meditate or when one walks meditation. And this is what I'm talking about here, about these smaller insights. Because once you gain those insights, then the problem should be overcome. As soon as you see the cause, the obstacle to the tranquility and contentment of monastic life or of the early stages of meditation, as soon as you see the obstacle, then straight away it disappears. That's the nature of these insights. It leads to peace, it leads to overcoming of those obstacles. To develop those insights, we have to be able to see things in a way we haven't seen before, because much of the problem is getting into particular ways of thinking, the ways of regarding monastic life or meditation, getting into conditioned habits, ruts if you like. So we keep coming across the same problem again and again and again. The way of insight is to find a way to look at that thing from a different angle, to get apart from it, beyond it if one can, to look above it, from below it, whatever, in order to fully understand what the problem truly is. And to do that, one can use the thinking mind at this stage to ask questions. But be careful that when you're doing this that you have enough mindfulness which makes sure that you do not keep on approaching the problem in the same old way. Because the problem of illusion or delusion is it does create these habits. The illusion or delusion in Buddhism is well described by the Buddha's teaching on the vipalasas, on the distortions of view, the distortions of perception, the distortions of conception or thought. And it's a basic psychology of cognition, the basic psychology of this thing we call knowing in these three different levels, the level of perception, the level of thought, and the level of view. And you should be able to understand that how, when you start on any of these three things, for example, perception, if you misperceive something, then you will misthink it, you will misconceive it. And if you misconceive it, that will bring up the wrong view. And because of that wrong view, that's the very reason why one misperceives things in the first place. I was talking with one of the monks here a couple of nights ago, and we were talking about jhanas and talking about one of the books in the library by the Christian nun Teresa of Avila, and talking about some of the things she said, whether that was jhana or not. And so I took the book out the other night and had a look through it, and it's very convoluted and it's very unclear exactly what she did have or not. You can't really make any conclusions from just what she wrote in there. There are some interesting passages, but what really struck me reading that book is even if there were experiences of things called jhana, just how they were misperceived and how they were thought to be something they truly are not. And you can understand why they were misperceived is because the very view which that Christian nun began her spiritual practice was a view which was based on the idea of God, the idea of divine beings and the whole dogma of Christianity. And it's because of that that when she would perceive anything, she would perceive it in those terms. And there'd be no way for her to perceive it in other terms. And for her, that would be reality, that would be truth. There's no way you would be able to convince her otherwise. Because especially at the level of perception, many people take what they perceive to be truth, to be the way things are, and not to understand the Buddha was even warning against perception, that it's part of this thing we call avijja, delusion. We perceive things according to our views. And because we perceive them in that way, we think about them in that way. We think about our experiences, if we're like a Christian nun, in terms of a god or a god figure. And that just confirms our views. And we get into these like cycles, these self-fulfilling cycles of wrong ideas, wrong perceptions and wrong thoughts, each one supporting the other. And because of that circle, one supporting the other, this circle of causality, that it's very hard to break. And that's a problem of illusion, that our illusions support one another. The whole framework of perception and thought and view, the whole thing that we call cognition, self supports its own delusions. And that's why it's so hard to break. And so we have to be careful of these habits of thought, these habits of thinking. And we have to be radical enough to challenge all of our views, even those which we think are correct and right. Everything you've ever heard, everything you've ever learned, to challenge a whole lot. Because amongst those things which one thinks are right view, there'll be some things which are wrong. And it's best to challenge them all, first of all. And so the way to challenge them all is to have the ability to look at things from a different perspective, again and again and again. If you find that your particular viewpoint, ideas, perceptions or thoughts or whatever aren't leading to tranquility, aren't leading to inner contentment and peace, then look at things from another way to try and see if then you can see the problem. The way of insight always comes when you see something you've never seen before. See it from a different perspective. I mentioned last year when I gave these talks during the Rains retreat, one of the signs of a deep insight is to shock you. Not to confirm your ideas, but to destroy them. That's the characteristic of the great insights. They destroy ideas. Because it's because of that cycle of view, perception, thought, view, perception, thought, that needs to be broken somewhere. Somewhere in that cycle needs to be cut so I can see things anew. And that will always shock and disturb. It will unsettle the secure systems which one has been building up over the years. So one develops such insight into just the ordinary things of monastic life. Just the problems which one has. Why is it that one some days isn't happy, isn't content? Whether it's with food, whether it's with getting up early in the morning or not getting up early in the morning, living with other people. That has to be a realm where one develops the insights and get these small insights over with very quickly, so that one can go into the deeper insights. If one hasn't got this external harmony with the world outside, then the sign of harmony with the world outside is a peaceful abiding in a monastery such as this. Then one has no hope of gaining the harmony of the mind, which is the peaceful abidings inside. So one works on the external insights, and those external insights are very worthwhile, but I'd rather not talk about those at the moment, because I hope that you all are doing well in gaining those insights into just the ordinary monastic life and how to live at peace and in harmony. Whenever there's a disagreement between monks, leave it alone. It's not important. Yeah. Rather than carrying that around with one, there's so many more important things to do with monastic life. So any disagreement, any disharmony outside, because it's small, it's light, let it go and give it away. It doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong. It's more important that one has peace inside the mind and harmony amongst the community. And having done that, then one can start developing the insights in which have to be gained on the way into the peaceful abidings of the mind. Whenever there's an obstacle to one's meditation, in other words, one sits down and one doesn't get peaceful, you have to ask yourself why. If you are dull, why? If you have too much energy and the mind is wandering, why? If you always have the same problem in the meditation, whatever that problem is, don't just attack it again and again with the same old methods when you know they haven't worked. Develop some insight. Because what's happening there is you're getting into a rut. There's some sort of wrong idea, wrong view there. There's some wrong perception, there's some wrong thought, which is like keeping the mind away from its natural state of peacefulness and silence and bliss. The natural state of the mind is quietness, is peace, is this inner contentment, the sense of being self-fulfilled, in the sense that the mind is just quite happy by itself, doesn't need to go anywhere. If one is going to talk about a natural state of the mind, that would be it. But the mind very rarely realizes its natural state, if you like. So why? What are the obstacles? And so it's up to us to develop those insights while we're sitting. The ability not just to make resolutions to gain calm, but the resolution to, on the way, as it were, on the journey, to look through the window and to know the territory we travel through when we meditate. To know it so well that we know the obstacles, we know the shortcuts, we know the difficulties, we know the problems. Well, as we gain insight into the methods of meditation, we gain such knowledges, such as like the importance of mindfulness. That becomes an insight when we see just how necessary, how vital it is to the gaining of these tranquil states of mind. Because when there's no mindfulness, we experience as the mind being out of control, and the mind just following defilements rather than being guided to quiet and peaceful states of mind. And so we can develop that insight into the nature of mindfulness. What is this thing which we call mindfulness? Remember, all the words, all the talks, all the books which you can ever read, they are only pointers. They're describing this thing which we call mindfulness. To really understand or know mindfulness, we have to experience it and experience its power. Experience what it's like when mindfulness isn't there. Or rather, experience the results after mindfulness hasn't been there. And this way we do get insights into the power and the nature of mindfulness. We know what this thing actually is as a phenomena rather than as a word. And we have to do these things because once we know the true nature of mindfulness, say, and its value, we'd be far less likely to abandon it or to not care for it when we first start to meditate. Very often when we meditate, we arouse mindfulness in the beginning, but we don't care for it. We don't sort of guard mindfulness. And by not guarding it, it just disappears somewhere while we're not looking. The insight into the ways of meditation just knows just the vital importance of this thing which we call the knowing of the mind and the memory of the instructions, the remembering the Dhamma. It's the aliveness of the mind. We know just how important that is, and if we can remember that, having seen that for ourselves through insight, then we've overcome a great obstacle to the quietening of the mind. And as we proceed further in the quietening of the mind, now we see other things which are so important. We just see things like the four Iddhipadas. We can gain insight into those, the chanda, the desire for the goal, the wirya, the energy, the application of the mind, and the investigation, and the sustaining of all these four. And we understand the Iddhipadas by watching what happens in meditation. We actually see when these things are there, what they really mean, and we understand why they have to be sustained to be true powers. Then once that insight, that understanding comes up very strongly, obviously those powers will be maintained. That sati will guard those and will not let them disappear or fade away. It will guard just the goal in your mind, what you wish to achieve. And again, the greatest goal to achieve, or the most powerful goal, is just to be quiet, to be peaceful, to be silent, to go to that which is peaceful, refined, which is beyond the world, because the world is the world of movement, of business, of doing, of agitation and vibration. We go into the world of quietness, of stillness. And just making that one's goal, to see how quiet, how still, how much of that which is movement, which is diversity, we can abandon. See how much we can abandon in one meditation sit. And as such, that's like an insight into the goal, an insight into the four Iddhipadas, which are so important to that goal. And we can see by developing that insight in our meditation that when these things aren't there, our meditation doesn't proceed very far. When those things are there, our meditation can go so strongly, so smoothly. We're gaining insight into the ways of the mind. And these are insights which are even more important than insights into how to be peaceful in the monastery. These are insights into the process of the Eightfold Path which leads to Nirvana. You're working with understanding the obstacles, and as soon as you understand the obstacles and overcome them, the path into peace becomes, as it were, smooth and trouble-free. You also understand, just as one is developing insight into the process of meditation, just how there is, one keeps the goal in mind, but there's also another type of desire which is actually stopping that peace happening, which is the restlessness of the mind, which always is looking for something else, even though it might be something noble. Instead of looking where you are, it's looking just one step ahead. And that one step ahead mind, always planning what you're going to do next, is again one of the great obstacles once the mind starts getting peaceful. It's the anticipation mind. Because the whole idea of samatha meditation, or of this path into peace, is like gaining this contentment in the moment with what you have. And in that contentment, the mind starts to calm down. And you gain insights into what you're doing wrong and what you're doing right. And sometimes when you gain insights, it seems so obvious, and you feel so stupid before. Why you didn't see that? Why you may have been spending years just on a path which leads nowhere? You see this for yourself in the meditation. This is like a bona fide insight. But to be able to do this, you have to be a bit radical, to challenge your old ways. Don't go around challenging other people's ways, that's a waste of time, or worrying what other people do or say or what their views are. Just look at your own and challenge every one of them. Especially if you get to a blockage in your practice, a blockage in the meditation. And when you challenge them and you look at it from a different angle, you start to see and you break down those barriers of illusion. And you can go further, and just the insight, once the mind starts to get very peaceful and very refined, you've given up that anticipation of the mind, you know, which is basic restlessness. And then just see why you can't go that last step, which is the reason it being is that there's still that controller there. You gain that insight yourself into the controlling mind, or that which we call a controller, that which appears to be a controller. And you see that that is one of the last obstacles to attaining a jhana. And that which appears as will, that which wants to do things. And you see that because the mind, when it goes into meditation, is alert. And it's mindful, it's clear. And it has the ability to look at something from a totally different perspective than one did before. And if one develops that ability, one can start to see, this is the problem. That thing inside of me which just wants to keep hold of the steering wheel of my mind, which wants to keep holding on to the reins, which will not let go. But the only way that you truly know that that's an obstacle is when you have enough insight, enough courage from that insight to let go of the will to do. to get let go of the controller and just see what happens. It's one of my favorite phrases, see what happens. The testing out, the looking, the finding, the trying a new way when one meditates, because that's a way where one truly gets great insights. And it's an insight which is not based on thinking, but an insight which starts to be based on experience. Because sometimes that, you know, we can think out things, and we can philosophize, and we can like read the suttas and see themes and running through the suttas and think we understand what these things actually are. But so often, the great intellectual minds who can see themes running through things sometimes get it all wrong. And certainly that from my experience doing things like physics or theoretical physics as a young man, just to see just how even the great minds who worked how things should be were shocked when they found out, well, it doesn't matter how things should be, that's not the way they truly are, according to the, the great experiments which were made. And a lot of people were shocked by that. Just whole theories had to be abandoned. Theories which had stood the test of time for many centuries had to be thrown away, because experiments shown they were wrong. And even your way of looking at the world had to be thrown away. One gives the example of in the Middle Ages, people thinking the world was flat. And because of that view, that idea, they actually perceived the world as flat. And they thought it was flat, and all their information from those perceptions and thoughts actually reinforced the view that it was obviously flat. And it took a great shock to be able to convince everyone that the world was actually round. In the same way that people think the universe is flat, and it takes a change of perception and view to understand the universe isn't flat, the universe is curved. It can have a certain size but have no boundaries. Finite yet infinite. And to actually understand that as a truth, to be able to get one's mind around that. And so often that, certainly in those theoretical physics, you're actually challenging ideas which were so basic to one's view of the world that it constantly shocked you. You had to throw away something which you thought was obvious. And so often it is that things we think of as obvious are actually untrue. Things which we think out and work out are very often untrue. And what we have to do is to go to a clear experience of the world, or clear experience of the mind. An experience which is not informed by our old views or our old ways of looking at things. That's the only way that we can get these true, full insights. The ones which really reveal the nature of the world to us. And to be able to break that cycle of view, perception and thought, the classic way which was developed by the Buddha was the abandoning of the five hindrances. Because the five hindrances are, as it were, like the effects of our wrong views. And these are the, because they're the effects of the wrong views, these are like the defiling workers who work at perception, who work at conception and thoughts, and mislead us into taking that which is not true to be true, that which is unreal to be real. And it's why that one develops insight to such a point, one develops samatha to such a point, one develops both to such a point that the five hindrances are fully abandoned. And even to do that much is a great achievement for a meditator. They've opened the door now to the insights which can fully abandon the hindrances, which can so fully abandon the fetters, the defilements. But not before you've abandoned all the hindrances. But just to go back a little bit, even understanding what the hindrances are, take a lot of insight. You may read about the hindrances, you may know their names in Pali, and know the great similes which the Buddha used to describe those hindrances. But that's all just pointers to what these things truly are. And like many things, the only time you know what a thing is once it's absent. And once you've overcome something, you know, that was the hindrance. Once you've overcome these things, you've been with them, you know when they're not there, that's when you truly know them, the experience of these things. You will only, those of you who've been in a monastery for a long time now, when you go out of the monastery, just to have to drive someone into town or something, that's the time when you start to appreciate or know the monastery. If you stay here all the time, sometimes you forget the monastery. When it's not there is when you really appreciate and know it. In the same way that when there's hindrances in the mind, sometimes you don't know those hindrances are there. And some of those hindrances, the five hindrances, are so subtle that it's only until they're fully overcome you truly understand the breadth and the nature of those hindrances. And of course, it's once one can get into something like a jhana, you know for sure the hindrances have gone. And you can use that experience to gain a very powerful insight into the nature of hindrances. Because when you don't know the nature of hindrances, you can be meditating and meditating and meditating with these hindrances operating again and again and again, and still never gaining either true samatha or true insights. Because remember, the hindrances are things which are weakness of wisdom, which are upakalesas of the mind. And as such, they block both tranquility and they block insight. And if we don't fully know them, and they're operating in there like lurking, as it were, without revealing their true identity, then again one will be blocked by the liberating wisdom of the Buddha, and will be blocked from that liberating wisdom of the Buddha. And so one has to have the full insight, so one knows these things completely. And once one has abandoned those five hindrances, one should also be able to develop the hindrance, be able to develop the insight to know that now the way is free for the development of Sambodhi, enlightenment wisdom. Because all of those old habits and the effects of those old views, those old perceptions, those old thoughts have been abandoned, cut off temporarily. And usually when the hindrances are overcome, it appears to the mind that one has like power, clarity, and one has the ability to be able to take up an object and fully contemplate it without the mind being distracted and disturbed by so many different things. So one has two things, a stability of mind which can take up an object and give it the necessary time to fully penetrate its meaning. One also has the power which the mind is so strong that whatever it takes up, it sees it, as it were, more fully, more deeply. Whenever you've developed a calm mind, whenever you've developed the abandoning of the hindrances, no matter what you watch, what you look, if you open your eyes, even the bricks on the wall of your hut will become beautiful. Amazing, just the colours inside of them. It's as if the mind has been scrubbed clean and you see the world, it's like shiny. It's brilliant. Simply because that the mind has got more power. It sees deeper, it hears more refined sounds. And if it's going to reflect it reflects with far greater penetration. It's a difference between like having a dull old knife which has been kept in the workshop without being looked after for the last 3 or 4 years. It's rusty, it's dull, and it can't even cut bread. And a knife which is sharp, just bought from the hardware store, and you can cut anything with it. And so like the different quality of a mind which is free of hindrances. And that's why the insight becomes far more powerful with a powerful mind. And if one is going to work towards those great insights which fully overcome the defilements which has kept you bound to this wheel of samsara, if one is truly going to investigate and understand the nature of things like the five khandhas, the nature of mind, the nature of anicca, dukkha, anatta, these things which we've talked about, we know the names of, we've heard the Buddha describe, we've even contemplated ourselves. If you truly want to understand these things, you need that degree of power, that great clarity of the mind which can look at an object and go straight to its heart. If not immediately, then having enough ability to sustain attention so that the thing opens up stage by stage until you fully penetrate its heart. For those of you who are here last year, you know that simile which I like to give of the thousand-petal lotus, where if a lotus comes up from the water, then it stands above the water. In the dawn, it's closed. It has to get heated by the sun until it starts to open. But as it starts to become heated by the sun, the first outermost petals are the only ones to receive that heat at first. And so they're the first ones which open, leaving 999 petals all closed up around the heart. And the sun has to keep on heating up that lotus. The next leaves open up, and the next ones. Sometime a person, maybe when 100 petals have opened up, will think, now that's the heart, that's the true nature, that's the essence, that's the Dhamma, that's the source. Not yet. You have to sometimes sustain attention on the object of your inquiry with that degree of power for such a long time until you reach the innermost petals. Three from the center, two from the center, one from the center. And the beautiful thing about the Dhamma is once that last petal opens up and you see the Dhamma, see what the Buddha saw, see Nibbana, see the Four Noble Truths, see dependent origination, see the five khandhas, see them all contained in that jewel in the center of the lotus, then you know that that's what the Buddha saw. You know that's the Dhamma. You've got an insight experience. But you need to have sustained attention for that long. You need that degree of clarity to be able to open up the whole lotus. Enlightenment is not an easy thing. Not many people achieve the stages of enlightenment in this teaching of the Buddha. This was the path which the Buddha taught. And you know this for yourself. At least you should do. Whenever you develop calm states of mind, you should know their power. The power of penetration, the power of sustained attention. You should also know that where the lotuses lie, which carry the jewel of enlightenment, and that's where the Buddha's teaching on Satipatthana comes in, just at that stage, not before. Because the Satipatthana, the focuses of mindfulness, of reflection, the Buddha taught were on the five khandhas. He taught them in the Satipatthana Sutta, just as in a fourfold division of the body, the first, of Vedana, failing sensation as a second, citta or consciousness, the third, and the Dharma objects. And you can put perception in all the mental formations in that. Or if you like, you can put perception with consciousness, because perception is very close to consciousness. But those four categories are supposed to cover the whole of the thing which we call body, the whole of the thing which we call mind. And in particular, that we have to look at these five khandhas. That if you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, you see that one of the things which is not pointed out often enough is not what we do, but why we do it. What's the purpose of this investigation, having abandoned the five hindrances? Why do we do this? What are we actually looking for? We're looking for the jewel in the lotus, and the Buddha gives this indication, just to know that it's just body, it's just Vedana, it's just Chitta, it's just Dhamma. That's all. Nothing more. Not mine. Not me. Not a self. One does the Satipatthana, these reflections on the khandhas, with this powerful mind, in order to uncover what the Buddha pointed to as the anatta realization. Because it's in this very area, in that which we call body, in that which we call mind, there's some area there where mindfulness has not penetrated, where one's insight is yet to do its work, some place where still lurks the idea, the perception, the view of a self, mine, me. That's why I invite everyone to find out where it is one is stuck. Not in the old ways, in the new ways. A new way of looking, to challenge so much, so courageously. It doesn't matter how scared you feel about giving up something precious, that you'll maintain your attention, your faculty of insight on that lotus, whether it's the body lotus, whether it's the Vedana lotus, whether it's a Chitta lotus, whether it's a Dhamma lotus, the Dhamma here being the mental objects, to sustain your attention on it until the whole of the Dhamma objects, the objects of the mind, just reveal themselves to be empty. Empty of mind, me, yourself. Nothing there at all. Until that insight becomes so powerful, so full, that there's no way ever again that one can ever take any of these khandhas to be a self, to be me or mine. And to know that these khandhas comprise everything of which one can be percipient of. Everything which can be known is here. One has the insight that one has looked to the very heart of the lotus, and there's nowhere else to look. One has found the truth of anatta. If it's a true insight, again, it will shock, it will explode one's old ideas. It explode the old perceptions and thoughts. That circle of views, perceptions and thoughts will be busted apart. That which has kept you on samsara, avijja, delusion, has been broken. So the powerful insight. These are not easy insights. You have to apply yourself and have to go against the stream of old ideas, old perceptions and old thoughts. These are the defilements, these are the armor of the defilements. you might call the defilements, sort of greed, hate and delusion, how do they manifest in the way you perceive things, in the way you think? They manifest in your views, your ideas. So we have to bust these apart, crack them with this powerful insight. Every time you have a really good sit, in especially if you get into a jhana, don't need to get into jhana twice, just get into it once. And at the end of that jhana, feel the power of the mind. Know its clarity, know its strength. As if a person just before they're about to enter some sporting event, just tests out their muscles. They feel the strength in their bones. They feel their will to sort of to reach their best. Then, having felt your power, then apply that power on the four satipatthanas. But remember why, to uncover anatta, to know this is just body, to know it so powerfully that you can never again even suspect there's a self in here, that you can truly abandon this body to its nature, that you can truly abandon Vedana, pleasantness, unpleasantness. It's nothing to do with the self, with the me, with the mind. The jitta, we can read the Kuba Ajahn in Thailand, Ajahn Mun, we can read the suttas, but that's just all ideas until we know what this thing jitta means through the deep powerful insights, and to see that the jitta is empty of a self, not me, not mine, not a self. To experience this so powerfully with all hindrances overcome, to know that this thing which is consciousness, that which knows, is nothing at all, just a natural phenomena, just a process. To see that just so fully, that that's all it is. And that which one thought to be something great, something marvellous, in other words, me, not at all. It's been deceiving you for lifetimes. It's the source of the hindrances, it's the source of the defilements, it's the source of craving. It's a house builder. It's the illusion inside. And see that the dhammas and mental objects, all these things which one cherishes, the thoughts, the feelings, the ideas, and you've been cherishing these for millennia. You've been cherishing rubbish. You've just been collecting shit and thinking it's wonderful. When you see this, you abandon these things. It's not a choice, it's not you who does the abandoning. The things lose their value and just depart. It's like Mara with its head bowed. The bhikkhu knows me. The bhikkhu knows me. When these things occur, you've done the job so far. You've seen the Dhamma through the powerful insights of the mind. It'll blow you apart for a while. Blissed out. Blissed out with the knowledge of freedom. The knowledge of freedom is one of the highest blisses one can experience. This is the power of these insights. Those insights will disappear, but their scent will always remain. They'll disappear because the first insights will often only result in you being a stream enterer, or maybe a once returner. That path then needs to be developed when you know the Dhamma and the view has been purified. You have to keep developing those insights until they become so strong. It's as if the lotus closes, as the sun goes down. And you need to open up that lotus again and again, so that you never even perceive or think in terms of a self. The very perception never arises in the mind. And when there's no self, there's nothing which belongs to a self, nothing which belongs to a me. You see, in the whole lotus, there's not something outside of the five khandhas which is a self. There's not something apart, beyond, contained in, or wherever. You see it in the whole thing we call world, existence, phenomena. There's no abiding entity we call me. It's a shock, but a beautiful shock, because it releases you from all the turmoil and trouble. You know that you're on the way out of samsara. You've got your ticket to leave. It's just a matter of time, how long it takes you to actually mount the stairs of the bus and say goodbye. Actually, again, no one mounts the stairs of the bus. Just the five khandhas wear themselves out. That's all there ever was. So you cannot call this annihilation. Sometimes the English words do an injustice to the Pali. Your Pali is called Ucheda, which means like the breaking up of something, the destroying of something. When there was nothing there in the first place, there's nothing destroyed. Or you can just say all that is destroyed is the defilements which kept this process going. That's what's destroyed, as though you can say it's annihilation. But all these are just words, and you may believe this, you may argue with this. The whole point of the talk is to point out a way, not to give you too many details of what you'll see when you open up that lotus. You have to see that for yourself. But you should know that if it truly is an insight, it has these characteristics. For one, it will shock you. Two, you will be very different afterwards than you were before. It will not confirm your view, but it will shatter your view. And third, it will lead to peace, to tranquil states of mind. The more insights you develop, the easier it is to calm the mind down. Remember when I talk about jhanas? Jhanas are states of letting go. They're the fruits of abandonment. Then they come as sukha, the happiness of renunciation. They are wholesome states of mind. They're kusala. They're uttari manusadhamma, states of superior human beings. The third jhana is the abiding of the Aryas. As the Aryas say, that happy is one who lives mindful and equanimous. These are noble states, and the test of one's understanding is the ability to achieve peaceful states of mind. That's why it says in the Kosambiya Sutta that that's one of the marvelous powers of a stream enterer. And they know that their view leads to such peaceful states. So you know whether it's an insight or whether it's just another way of another worldly view, another way of looking at life in a philosophical way. So that is what insight is all about, the best I can explain it to you this evening. So may you not neglect insight. May it go hand in hand with your peaceful mind states, and may you develop those states which are so free of the hindrances and so powerful, and apply that mind in these areas to fully see the Dhamma, the most beautiful thing, and be released. That's all I have to say this evening. Are there any comments or questions?